So I remember one Christmas growing up, I'd have been about the boys' age, so in middle school, I so very badly wanted a Sony Discman. Yeah, not the Walkman, but the Discman that played CDs. And it was like, it was one of those years, it was the only thing on my Christmas list. Mom and Dad had to get it for me. Like, I sacrificed everything else for the Discman. And like, I was already picturing the 2-hour drive on Christmas Day to my aunt and uncle's house. It was gonna be great. I was gonna listen to like all 5 of my CDs, okay? Use Your Illusions 1 and 2, Nirvana's Nevermind album, Metallica's Black album, and Boyz II Men Cooley High Harmony. It wasn't just metal and grunge for this farm boy. Kicker is like Christmas Eve came. We opened most all of our Christmas presents on Christmas Eve, and it wasn't there. But I was like, you know what? That's all good, because you know what? Are there any little kids that stayed up here? Santa was going to bring it the next morning. And so it was all good. Thank you. Santa was going to bring it the next morning, right? Clearly. If mom and dad forgot, Santa was going to get me covered. It wasn't there, guys. Yeah, can we like a little bit more of that? Yeah. Drama. It's the only thing I wanted, and I didn't get it. And to like say that I was disappointed was an understatement. I'm pretty sure I acted like a 3-year-old who was hangry all Christmas Day. But like we've all faced some disappointments of various kinds, haven't we? Canceled plans, failed attempts, unrealized dreams and broken promises. Frustrated that something's not going the way you hoped or that someone's not doing what you had hoped, either because they couldn't, they were unable, or worse, because they wouldn't, because they were unwilling. And we even feel a sense of disappointment with God sometimes, don't we? We feel that sense of disappointment with God when he doesn't do what we want, when we wanted, the way we wanted. And that's how the followers of Jesus, I think, were feeling that Sunday morning, just 2 days after the death of Jesus, having lost their rabbi and spiritual leader, having lost their friend whom they loved, and with him, their hopes and their dreams for who he was or who they thought he was as Messiah and what it is they hoped he would do. And now it was all over. It was like somebody let the air out of a balloon and it wasn't away. And the band was beginning to break up. And two of his followers who were there that Sunday morning, they left. They left town. And they began this trip heading back home to Emmaus. And they were hopeless. I mean, they were filled with serious disappointment. And it's there on the road to Emmaus, we see the first of 3 stories of encountering the risen Jesus here in this final chapter of Luke. And we began this story last week by encountering the presence of Jesus as Jesus approached the travelers. And we're going to continue in this story this morning by encountering Jesus in our disappointment. As Jesus, he interacts with these travelers and he asks them a couple of questions that not only reveal their disappointments, but reveal their underlying desires of who they hoped this Jesus would be and what they hoped he would do. And as we continue making our way through the story, we're going to ask the same 3 questions this morning that we asked last week. And if you remember, the first question was, what are we learning from his followers? What are we learning from these 2 travelers in this story? Second question, what are we learning about Jesus? About who he is as we seek to know him more. And the third question is, what are we learning from Jesus as we seek to grow to be more like him, formed into his image? So keep those questions in mind as we go through the story. And so we jump in here, and Jesus, as he approached these followers, he asked them his first of 2 questions in verse 17. And he comes up to them, and he's essentially asking, like, what y'all talking about? Like, well, what's this conversation you're having with each other as you walk? Now remember, they didn't recognize him. They didn't recognize that this was Jesus. Last week we saw Luke tell us that their eyes were kept from recognizing him. They thought this was just some other random guy who had gone to Jerusalem for the Passover and was on his way back home, interrupting their conversation. Like, no introduction. Hi, my name's Jesus. No chit-chat about, man, it's a great day today, isn't it? It's going to almost be 80. Where'd you guys stay for the Passover? Did you have a good time? Good trip, yeah? None of that. And you know how sometimes you can just tell when someone's having a bad day? Last week, for example, Dan and Colette walked in, and she just stood there, and she just did a, She was doing the calculation. She's like, "You're not well today, are you?" And like, that's not a thing you would typically say to someone. We know each other well enough. Yeah, I was like, "No, it's been a rough day and a rough week and a rough month and a rough year." And she's like, "You want to talk about it?" I was like, "Yeah." And it was like, you know, mom and dad pulling you aside to just listen. She just knew. You can tell. Like, we think we're good actors. There's no Oscars going out to us and hiding our emotions. Like, you can see it in people's faces and the way they look. You can see it in their posture, the way they stand, the way they walk. And that was them. Jesus, when he approached them, they just stopped. And they just stood there, standing still. And it was as though they were lost, as though they had forgotten where they were going and what they were doing, and they were looking sad. They're just looking down at the ground, like they couldn't even make eye contact with him and all thing. Just, you know, like kicking the ground off, rock off the ground, be like, "Oh, here's a sticky note on the thing. I don't know." Anything to distract themselves. And they were journeying through what we referred to last week as liminal space. Liminal coming from the Latin word that means threshold, right? They were standing on that threshold of disappointment, unable to fit the pieces of the puzzle together in a way that made sense to them. And then they were entering into an unknown future that didn't look anything like what they had hoped for, what they had dreamed of, and what they had spent these last 3 years working towards. And they were so overwhelmed with grief and disappointment that it quickly turned to anger. And one of them, Cleopas, he just snapped at this guy and he totally goes off on him. He's like, "Do you really not know what's going on? Are you the only visitor who came to Jerusalem who doesn't know everything that's happened these past few days? Like, really? 250,000 people in town. Everyone's talking about it, and yet somehow you missed it? Like, how is that even possible?" Imagine you're outside with a group of friends. Let's say this past Monday at, I don't know, say like 2:07 in the afternoon, roughly. And somebody walks up to you and your friends, and they see you looking up at the sky. And they're like, "What you looking at? UFO? Airplane? What is it?" And like, "What are those weird glasses you're wearing? Is it a 3D movie up there?" And he'd be like, "Are you the only person that doesn't know what's going on today?" It's easy in the midst of our grief and disappointment to just snap at someone, isn't it? Someone who doesn't get what's going on. Even when it's an innocent stranger who asks a harmless question like, "What you talking about? What you looking at?" And so this brings us to our first of the three questions. What do we learn from the travelers? And I think one of the things that we learn is that when you're angry, it's really easy to get angry at others. It's really easy to be angry at anyone and everyone, often taking your anger out on whoever's closest and most convenient. It's what psychologists refer to as displacement, which according to the APA, the American Psychological Association, is the transfer of feelings or behaviors from their original object to another person or thing. It's a defense mechanism. It's redirecting our negative emotions of anger and grief and anxiety and disappointment from their original source to a less threatening object, and effectively making someone or something else the scapegoat and lashing out at them. It's, for example, redirecting your anger, as you say you're on vacation, redirecting your anger at the airline for canceling your flight after 4 constant delays when the sun's in the sky, not a cloud in the sky, and you take your anger out on that poor gate agent who's doing their best to get everybody on a flight home. They didn't do anything to you. They didn't cause the cancellation. Or taking your anger at your boss out on your coworkers or those who work for you, or taking it home and taking it out on your family. It's taking out your anger on your anger with your spouse, taking that out on your kids, or taking your anger with your kids out on your spouse. It's taking your anger that you felt about someone in your past and taking that out on someone in your present, someone who doesn't have anything to do with it, doesn't even know anything about it. See, displacement is your mind's unconscious attempt to reduce your anger and release your anxiety by projecting it on someone else. Just getting it out there. And temporarily, like, it offers a quick little fix, doesn't it? It makes you feel good for a little bit. But what you're doing is you're hoping to restore some sense of emotional balance when everything's out of balance, when everything's off. Especially when your rhythms are off, right? When you're tired because you're not sleeping. When you're hangry because you haven't eaten, or at least you're not eating well. And I think this helps us start to explain why, like, conspiracy theories were incredibly prevalent over the course of the pandemic, weren't they? And our rhythms were incredibly off in the midst of the pandemic, weren't they? I also think it helps to explain why we are so quick to blame entire groups of people for the problems we're facing that they had absolutely nothing to do with. Here's the kicker, though. That in no way resolves the conflict. It only exasperates it. It makes it worse, straining your relationships. Now, if you've ever had someone snap at you and go off at you, feeling like it came out of nowhere, you're like, wait, what did I miss? Like, you felt like you were coming in the middle of an argument that you weren't invited to. And you're like, what did I do? What did I not do? And when you're on the receiving end of this enough times from someone, you eventually just start to back away. It strains your relationships, and it perpetuates a cycle of anger and violence. It's so easy for your own defense mechanisms to kick in. You puff out your chest, you start firing back at them, you're threatening when you feel threatened, and it just spirals. But not Jesus. He didn't do any of that. No, rather than escalating the tension, he eases it. Rather than projecting his anxiety on them, he absorbs it from them. And he does it by asking a very simple follow-up question. What things? It's like mind-blowing. Rather than slamming the door in their face and storming off, you know, offended at how they acted towards him, he does the exact opposite, doesn't he? He opens the door. He opens it a bit further, and he extends an invitation to them. He's inviting them to share their story with him. And mind you, it's not because he doesn't know the answer. It's not because he doesn't remember all that happened. Right? It's not like the resurrection came with a case of amnesia. He's like, I woke up. I was on a hard surface. I was all wrapped up, and I don't know how I got there. What things happened? That'd make a great movie. And it also, it wasn't like he wanted to get caught up on all the juicy gossip while he was away, being like, tell me everything that happened. Everything in order. Who freaked out? Who freaked out first? It was Peter, wasn't it? Peter freaked out. John was the calm one. Peter freaked out, didn't he? Jesus knew every detail about everything that happened. He had all the pieces to the puzzle. He not only knew what happened, he knew why it happened. He knew how the pieces fit together. He knew the picture that they made. And so here's what, Jesus isn't asking for himself so that he can learn something he doesn't know. He's asking for them so that they can learn something they don't yet fully know. He's asking for them. He wants to reveal to them not only their disappointments, but their underlying desires. And what we see is, like, Jesus is so incredibly patient, isn't he? He's so patient. And he's so kind. You're like, you're the nicest guy I've ever met. I just yelled at you and you asked me a question. What he's doing is he's creating a safe space for them to share their frustrations, to share their disappointments. And he does one of the single most loving things for someone to do with someone who's suffering. And you know what that is? He listens. He listens as they share. And what I love is, like, Jesus isn't rushing to put the pieces of the puzzle together for them. He's just coming alongside them. And he wants to help them begin to put the pieces of the puzzle together so they can see the picture. And like that two words, but things. Not just the words, but the tone, the body language. They immediately sense his patience. They felt safe in his presence, and they're already calming down. They're more at ease, and they slowly begin to open themselves up to this stranger, this rando, answering his question and sharing their story. And they're like, we were talking about what happened to this guy we know. His name was Jesus. He's from the town of Nazareth up north in Galilee. You may have heard of, I guess you didn't hear of him. But man, he was amazing. He was a man of God. It was like he had divine power. He was wise. He was a prophet, mighty in deed and in word. And like, as I was reading through this, I started thinking, like, how does Jesus not keep from bursting out laughing right now? He's like, and say, like, guys, it's me. I'm right here. Fooled you. But he doesn't. He just keeps listening. Patiently listening as they share. Because again, he's not trying to put the pieces of the puzzle together for them. He's not trying to do their homework for them. That's the quick and easy way. When your kids bring home homework, it's easy to just do the math for them. It's a whole lot more messy and slow if you sit down and help them with the math. Because you got to first remember the math. Jesus wants to put the pieces of the puzzle together with you, not for you. So they go on. They keep talking. They're like, our own chief priests and rulers, they're the ones who delivered him over to the Romans to be condemned to death. And like, our own people did this to him. Because see, they don't have the authority to exercise capital punishment. They didn't have the authority to crucify themselves. They didn't have the authority to condemn him to death. But they did all this in hopes of, like, quieting him and putting a stop to this disturbance that he'd raised. And then after, like, this big party we had last Sunday, they crucified him on Friday. Our friend and our leader was nailed to a cross like a criminal, like a traitor. And as they share their story, they're beginning to connect their disappointment that they're feeling with the underlying desires that were driving them, their hopes, their dreams, specifically who they hoped Jesus to be and what they hoped Jesus would do. They said, but we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. We hoped he was the one who would deliver us. We hoped he was the one that God promised to send, this Messiah that we've been waiting centuries for. Remember, they had lived for centuries under the rule of one oppressive nation under another. Babylonians, then came the Greeks, now came the Romans. And so, remember, each year, the people performed the poems from the Book of Lamentations that we looked at during this last season of Lent, crying out to God, restore us to yourself, O Lord, that we may be restored, renew our days of old. And so when they heard this guy named Jesus a couple of years ago going around declaring that the kingdom of heaven was at hand, when they saw him riding into Jerusalem just a week earlier on the colt of a donkey, they began to wonder if he was the king that was promised to David, if he was the king prophesied by Zechariah that would return. They hoped Jesus would be the one who would come in power, a warrior Messiah who would lead this rebellion against Rome, bringing about a national liberation, right? Restoring them as God's people, resurrecting God's kingdom and renewing the days of old, the days of David and Solomon, making Israel great again and making their lives better and easier and more comfortable by taking them back to the good old days. Days of safety and security, back to the kingdom of power and prominence, with Jesus reigning as their king. But like so many other so-called self-proclaimed messiahs who came and went, failing to fulfill the promises that they had made, Jesus died And God's kingdom was nowhere in sight, so they thought. Apparently it was at hand, but it hadn't fully broken through. And they said, it's now the third day since all these things have happened. And their hope for who he was and what he would do died with him. And like, not only that, though, it's like there were some women in our group, and they told us a rather amazing story. After they went and visited the tomb this morning, but their story confused us because they said they didn't find the body that we left there on Friday. Their story didn't make any sense. They told us about how they'd seen a vision of angels who had said that he was alive, but like that didn't make any sense either. And so. A couple of these other guys, they were closer to Jesus. They'd been with him since the beginning. They went and checked it out for themselves, and when they got to the tomb, they found it just as the women said. Like his body was gone. All that was left was the linens, but they didn't see Jesus. He's gone. It's over. And so we're headed home to figure out what's next. We don't really know where to go from here. And so, what do we learn about Jesus here? What do we learn as we seek to not only know more about him, but seek to know him more intimately, more personally? Next week, we're going to see, man, Jesus, he was indeed a prophet, mighty in word. Words of Jesus, wow. And he was powerful, mighty indeed. He was. And like no deed more powerful than the resurrection, amen? Ain't seen anybody ever do that before or since. Next week, we're going to see how he used the fulfillment of promise, how every Old Testament Hebrew scripture makes its way and points to him describing everything that happened exactly as it happened. But that's next week. I don't want us to jump past this. So what do we learn in this week's passage? What we learn here is that Jesus is so incredibly patient with us. So patient. You know, that he didn't ever rush them. You don't see any, Luke doesn't write down about how Jesus kept looking at his watch, thinking he had somewhere to be, getting ready to cut them off and get going. Hey, could you just give me the summary of the story? Give me like the 2-minute version, not the 20-minute version. He didn't cut them off. Instead, what Jesus did is he came alongside them. He met them where they were at in their journey. He slowed his pace to their pace rather than dragging them along. Patiently walking with them on their journey, patiently listening to them as he told their story. We're not always like Jesus, though, are we? We get a little pushy sometimes, and when we get pushy, we push people away. We get a little overbearing at times, can we just be honest? We're a little too much at times. We're a little too much for people at times. And when we get pushy, we push people away. But when people are patient, man, it draws you in. And Jesus is drawing us in just as he did these two travelers, calming our fears in his presence, quieting the anxieties, easing the tensions rather than escalating them simply by being patient with us. Patient with you, patient with me. And you know what that means? It means God's not disappointed in you. Let me say that again. God's not disappointed in you. Even when you're disappointed in him. Even though you have sinned against him time and time and time again. Remember those first couple commandments we read? Man, y'all broken them probably in the last 5 minutes. And you're just sitting here. God's not angry with you. God's not done with you. God's not given up on you. No matter how many times you failed and no matter how far you have fallen. And you know what else he's not doing? God ain't comparing you to anyone else. God's not that frustrated parent who's comparing you to the siblings. Why can't you be more like them? He's not disappointed in you for not knowing more than you do. He's not disappointed in you for not being further along than you are. And he's not disappointed in you for not going any faster than you're able to go. And Jesus just wants you to come to him, to follow him, to open up to him, to share everything with him, knowing full well he already knows. And I hope that that's comforting. Because it means, like, Jesus isn't that overbearing boss who's looking at you for that weekly status report before you leave the office on Friday. It's not about him learning something he doesn't already know as though he's somehow missing a puzzle from your life. It's about him patiently helping you learn something you might not fully know so that he can help you put the pieces of the puzzle together. One more time, God's not disappointed in you. God loves you. And you know how I know? Like, I look at that thing. Like, God came to us. He came to you. He came to me. He came to us. And he dwelt among us to live amongst us, to die for us, to rescue us, to forgive us. And he's calling out to you to come to him, to share your disappointments and your frustrations with him. Those times that when something didn't go the way you hoped, when someone didn't do what you hoped, even when that someone is God, he wants you to bring that to him. Because what happens is we share our greatest disappointments with him, he begins to reveal our deepest desires, revealing when our desires align with his, trusting God and turning to God and desiring what he desires, and also revealing when they don't. He reveals when our desires lead us in living out God's will, right? And according to his way, in obedience to his word, right? Faithfully following the way of Jesus and obedience to the words of Jesus, and when they don't. And it reveals when our desires lead us in being a light to the nations, in helping others know Jesus and grow to be like Jesus, and when they don't. When our desires are about the good of others and when they're about ourselves. Every step of the journey, Jesus patiently shaping your desires, forming you into his image as we grow to be more like Jesus. Okay, so if we're going to grow, what is it that we learn from this passage from Jesus? I think we learn here how to patiently listen to others. How to patiently listen. Listening may be one of the most selfless, loving acts there is. To the point that Anabaptist professor Dr. David Augsburger writes, being heard, being truly listened to, it is so close to being loved that for the average person, they are almost indistinguishable. Because see, by listening to others, we're able to learn about others from the stories they tell and learn from others, from the experiences that they have gone through that are different from ours. By listening, we learn, and that leads us to be able to love them in the midst of whatever it is that they are going through. And so think for a second. Who is the greatest listener you know? Who is that person that you know if you have something to share, they're going to listen to you? And who is it, and what is it that makes them such a good listener? What makes you want to go share it with them? It's likely a number of things, a number of traits that make up what some refer to as incarnational listening. When you hear the word incarnation, you think about the incarnation of Jesus, Emmanuel, God's presence with us, incarnational listening. It's this way of listening that is fully present and attentive. Listening to their words, learning from their story, also that you can love them in the midst of what they're experiencing. And as I was jotting things down, I think we kind of see like roughly six traits that I want to share with you, six traits of incarnational listening. And the first is this, and this may be the most important one. Incarnational listening is not about you. Listening is not about you. It's about the person you're listening to. Right? It is about creating space rather than consuming it. Which is exactly what we do when we interrupt their story, when we interject with our own, hijacking the conversation. Like, I know exactly how you feel. It's just like this one time that we've all done it, and we've all had it done to us. And it's a sign that rather than listening, you're simply waiting to speak. Big difference. Number one, incarnational listening is not about you. Number two, incarnational listening is fully present. Fully present. Giving your full self, listening attentively, looking at them as you listen to them. That's a step. And seeking to eliminate all the distractions and silence all the interruptions. And we have no shortage today. So little things. Silence the notifications. Put your phone on do not disturb. Better yet, put your phone away. Better yet, turn your phone off. Close the laptop lid. Turn the screen monitor away. Turn the TV off. But not only that, silence yourself for a little bit. Put yourself on do not disturb. Meaning, let them finish their own sentences. You don't need to finish them for them. That doesn't do what you think it does. It's not about you. It is fully present. Number three, incarnational listening, it asks questions. And not out of a morbid curiosity, but out of a desire to learn more about them, to learn from them. It asks questions. It asks good questions. Not all questions are the same. Get to know the real them that uncovers what's hidden, revealing what's missing, like Jesus did. He would ask those who were following him, he asked, what are you seeking? You want to follow me, but where is it you want me to lead you? Do you know? He would ask those who would approach him, what do you want me to do for you? Let's make sure we're on the same page here. The French Trappist monk Thomas Merton writes, ask me not where I live or what I like to eat. I live in Arlington Heights and I like to eat deep dish and tavern style pizza. Both are good in Chicago, amen. Don't ask me that, that's boring. Instead, ask me this, let's get to it. Ask me what I think I'm living for. Ooh. And ask in detail. And ask me what I think is keeping me from living fully for the thing that I want to live for. That's a conversation. That's more than pepperoni and jalapenos on my Giorgio's pizza. Ask good questions, but also ask follow-up questions, right? Especially when you're confused by what was said, you're not sure what was meant. Or ask follow-up questions, we think, I think we're going somewhere here to further the discussion. That's what Jesus did. What things? What things? Ask questions, ask good questions, ask follow-up questions. Number four, incarnational listening, it is not in a hurry, but waits patiently. Because the thing about good questions that help uncover and reveal, they take time to answer. I don't know if the thing that I'm living for in detail, I got to think about that for a second. Patiently waiting, because it takes time to answer. It might even take a few attempts to answer. Like you start down one path, you're like, no, that's not it. And then you go down this path, that's not it. But creating space for them to explore their answers, to find their words, not answering for them. But also, here's the thing. It's kind of a little pet peeve of mine. Don't ask a question unless you're willing to wait for and listen to the answer. Here's an example that we probably all did this morning. Don't ask someone how they're doing unless you actually want to know how they're doing. Don't make a greeting that should be a statement, a question. Don't ask someone how they're doing unless you actually want to know how they're doing, patiently waiting for an honest answer. Something other than good. The reason we respond with good is because we don't think you actually care. We don't think you actually want to hear. Because it's messy. Do you really want to know? It might take us a half hour. And service starts, like the timer's going down. We got 14 seconds. I'm good. Let's go. Patiently waiting for an honest answer and then listening to the whole answer. Otherwise, let's just do this. Just like, man, it is so good to see you this morning. That's okay to say. Make sense? It's not in a hurry, but wait patiently. Number five. Incarnational listening embraces the silence. It doesn't tolerate the silence, it embraces it rather than avoiding it. But like, man, we don't do well with silence, do we? We've been practicing silence after the sermon for nearly 2 years now, and we're still not quite sure about that. I heard the quiet amens right there. Silence is awkward and uncomfortable. We don't do well with it. I remember in my days at Motorola, whenever we would work with a Japanese customer or the Japanese account team, they were so comfortable with silence. The conference call would be so quiet for so long, you'd be like, are you on mute? Did we drop? I'm sorry. And you know what we would, everybody from our side, we're rushing in. We want to answer the question. They're not there. What happened? But we do, we rush in, we feel the silence, and we feel it with noise. We feel it with words that hurt often rather than words that help. We say things like, you should just be grateful for what you have. You know, at least it's not like what happened to me. Let me tell you my story. Or, you know what, you're overreacting. It's really not that big of a deal. Just get over it. We feel the silence with words that hurt rather than help. We feel the silence offering unsolicited advice. You know, if you just had more faith. You know, you should probably pray more. You're clearly not praying enough. You know, why don't you do what I did? It worked for me. Oh, and by the way, here's what worked for me. Let me tell you that. We offer unsolicited advice. We offer silver linings and pithy platitudes. God has a plan for you. You just haven't figured it out yet. This is God testing you. What is God teaching you? And maybe that's true. Usually we come back at that at a very inappropriate time when someone's not ready to hear it. Or my favorite, here's a Bible verse for you. Bye. And hear me, some of these things may be appropriate at another time. Not at that time. Because here's the deal. None of this is about alleviating their discomfort. It's about alleviating your own discomfort with the silence. Failing to wait patiently for them to find their words, making the conversation about you, consuming the space, and always feeling the need to contribute to the conversation, thinking that your words matter more than your presence. Dietrich Bonhoeffer in his book, Life Together. Have I quoted from this before? He says, I love how he just calls us out. He says, we forget that listening can be a greater service than speaking. Some of us are like, I didn't forget it because I didn't know it. We forget that listening can be a greater service than speaking. Many people are looking for an ear that will listen. They're not even going to wait for two. They'll just take one. You know what he says next? They do not find it among Christians. Because these Christians are talking when they should be listening. But he who can no longer listen to his brother or his sister will soon no longer be listening to God either. And that leads us to number six. It's that incarnational listening remains attentive to God. Attentive to the Spirit's leading in the conversation, leading you to speak and the words to speak, and leading you to remain silent and continue listening. And that's the type of listening that we practice in our formation groups in The Way, this 3-year spiritual journey a few folks have joined us on. And we begin with a time of opening prayer. We have a liturgy to begin, a time of prayer and a reading of a psalm. And then each person in the group, 3-4 people, takes a turn sharing something that's on their heart. A struggle, a burden they're carrying. Taking a very courageous step of opening themselves up to others, being vulnerable with others. And then you know what the group does? It holds it in silence. We put our hands out and we hold it in silence for a minute with them, in solidarity together with them. And after that minute of silence, each person prays for that person. And then we go on to the next and they share. No unsolicited advice. At least not in that space. The person sharing is able to invite feedback, but it's not imposed on them by the group. Because we're practicing incarnational listening, to be quick to listen, slow to speak, present as we listen, patiently present, listening in order to learn as a way to love. Listen, learn, love. As we grow to not only be more like Jesus, but love like Jesus.